empty and marvelous. The opening words of the oldest Zen poem say that the perfect way, Tao, is without difficulty, save that it avoids picking and choosing. Only when you stop liking and disliking will all be clearly understood. A split hair's difference and heaven and earth are set apart. If you want to get the plain truth, be not concerned with right and wrong. The conflict between right and wrong is the sickness of the mind. The point is not to make an effort to silence the feelings and cultivate bland indifference. It is to see through the universal illusion that what is pleasant or good may be wrested from what is painful or evil. To see this is to see that good without evil is like up without down, and that to make an ideal of pursuing the good is like trying to get rid of the left by turning constantly to the right. One is therefore compelled to go around in circles. Zen is a liberation from this pattern, and its apparently dismal starting point is to understand the absurdity of choosing, of the whole feeling that life may be significantly improved by a constant selection of the good. One must start by getting the feel of relativity, and by knowing that life is not a situation from which there is anything to be grasped or gained, as if it were something which one approaches from outside, like a pie or a barrel of beer. To succeed is always to fail, in the sense that the more one succeeds in anything, the greater is the need to go on succeeding. To eat is to survive to be hungry. The illusion of significant improvement arises in moments of contrast, as when one turns from the left to the right on a hard bed. The position is better so long as the contrast remains, but before long the second position begins to feel like the first, so one acquires a more comfortable bed and, for a while, sleeps in peace. But the solution of the problem leaves a strange vacuum in one's consciousness, a vacuum soon filled by the sensation of another intolerable contrast, hitherto unnoticed, and just as urgent, just as frustrating as the problem of the hard bed. Zen does not take the attitude that it is so futile to eat when hungry that one may as well starve, nor is it so inhuman as to say that when we itch, we should not scratch. Disillusionment with the pursuit of the good does not involve the evil of stagnation as its necessary alternative, for the human situation is like that of fleas on a hot griddle. None of the alternatives offer a solution, for the flea who falls must jump, and the flea who jumps must fall. Choosing is absurd because there is no choice. And from this point of view, one can see the sun in the midst of the rain, scoop clear water from the heart of the fire. But the viewpoint is not fatalistic. It is not simply submission to the inevitability of sweating when it is hot, shivering when it is cold, eating when hungry, and sleeping when tired. Submission to fate implies someone who submits, someone who is the helpless puppet of circumstances, and for Zen there is no such person. The duality of subject and object, of the knower and the known, is seen to be just as relative, as mutual, as inseparable as every other. We do not sweat because it is hot. The sweating is the heat. It is just as true to say that the sun is light because of the eyes as to say that the eyes see light because of the sun. The viewpoint is unfamiliar because it is our settled convention to think that heat comes first and then, by causality, the body sweats. To put it the other way around is startling, like saying cheese and bread instead of bread and cheese. Thus the Zen Rinkushu says, "Fire does not wait for the sun to be hot, nor the wind for the moon to be cool." This shocking and seemingly illogical reversal of common sense may perhaps be clarified by the favorite Zen image of the moon in the water. The phenomenon moon in the water is likened to human experience. The water is the subject, and the moon the object. When there is no water, there is no moon in the water, and likewise when there is no moon. But when the moon rises, the water does not wait to receive its image, and when even the tiniest drop of water is poured out, the moon does not wait to cast its reflection. For the moon does not intend to cast its reflection, and the water does not receive its image on purpose. The event is caused as much by the water as by the moon, and as the water manifests the brightness of the moon manifests the clarity of the water. To put it less poetically, human experience is determined as much by the nature of the mind and the structure of its senses as by the external objects whose presence the mind reveals. Men feel themselves to be victims or puppets of their experience because they separate themselves from their minds, thinking that the nature of the mind-body is something involuntarily thrust upon them. They think that they did not ask to be born, did not ask to be given a sensitive organism to be frustrated by alternating pleasure and pain. But Zen asks us to find out who it is that has the mind, and who it was that did not ask to be born before father and mother conceived us. Thence it appears that the entire sense of subjective isolation, of being the one who was given a mind and to whom experience happens, is an illusion of bad semantics. For there is no myself apart from the mind-body, which gives structure to my experience. It is likewise ridiculous to talk of this mind-body as something which was passively and involuntarily given a certain structure. It is that structure, and before the structure arose, there was no mind-body.